WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of people don't know what to make of Sandra Bernhardt. When is she serious? When is she putting us on? When is she in persona? And who is she when she's just herself? On The Letterman Show, she was wild. From her hit off-Broadway show, Without You, I'm Nothing, you got a sense of her as someone who has always been infatuated with show business and imagined herself in the shoes of everyone from Barbra Streisand to Prince. Now that she's a regular on Roseanne, she's reaching a mass audience and, for better or worse, getting the fame she always dreamed of. But being on a popular sitcom is not stopping her from pursuing her own idiosyncratic vision. Sandra Bernhardt has a new book of short stories called Love, Love, and Love. Before we talk, here's an excerpt of a piece in which she offers her experienced advice to the new crop of young beauties in Hollywood. She tells them how to deal with a business run by short, frustrated men.
So how do you handle it, short of getting an attitude? Use some psychology. If you sense hostility coming from a casting director or fat, unattractive producer, just pretend he's your uncle and humor him. Take him into your confidence and make him feel as if it's you and him against the world. Talk about football or your favorite cocktail. Guy talk. Like, I've got $50 on the Broncos. I think they're going to kick some butt. What about you? Don't act all girly and giggly. Be kind of tough in a sexy way. Sit on the edge of the couch instead of getting comfortable. Run your hands through your hair and slap them on the back. Oh, Joel, you're a scream. I love your Roseville pottery collection. It's one of the best I've ever seen. Hey, don't worry. If I'm wrong for this part, we'll do something else together. I mean, I just dig you, and I really want to be friends. Drive a motorcycle like the kind Brando rode in The Wild One. It's de rigueur now, so get yourself a beat-up leather jacket, some used cowboy boots, and make sure your hair is really long and definitely do not wear a helmet. Drive up and down Melrose with a cigarette hanging out of the corner of your mouth and weave confidently in and out of traffic. Don't worry, you won't fall off. Show up a few minutes late and really rev your engines as you pull up for your audition at Warner Brothers. All the young execs will be scared but blown away. Talk about your record deal on Virgin, even if you don't have one. They'll believe you. Tell them you've been living in Paris, hanging out with Mickey Rourke, and there's a damn good chance you'll get the job. It's essential to develop some gay allies as well. Get in with the gay mafia, powerful producers, execs, etc. Fix them up with some of your really cute boyfriends. Don't worry, they won't have to do anything except act disinterested. If it doesn't work out, they won't blame you. They'll just ask you to find some more beautiful boys who'll reject them. Be a good friend and take their calls at 6 a.m. and listen while they cry the blues about how no one ever loves them, and you'll be a superstar overnight. Go to clubs, but not every week. Get everybody interested and then disappear. When you show up again, they'll be so desperate they'll promise you anything and everything you want, including the Mercedes 450 SL. And baby, you deserve it. You can date one of these guys, but make sure you keep one of his friends hanging on the line just in case. Alternate a hot actor and an older director, and maybe toss in a producer or two. And always keep an agent on hold. Get some headshots from Herb Ritz. Have Sally Hershberger cut your hair. Work out at Gold's Gym and sleep late. That's my best advice for you girls, you hot, happening, groovy stars of today. Play by their rules, and you'll never grow old.
That's Sandra Bernhardt reading from her new book, Love, Love, and Love. Sandra, when did you start writing?
Well, you mean originally?
Yeah.
I guess I was about 11 or 12 when I started writing poetry and keeping diaries.
What kind of poetry was it?
Haikus and...
they were really big.
You know, I mean, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, haikus were, you know, essential.
Absolutely. And were your diaries confessional?
Oh, always. Extremely confessional.
And were they imaginative, too? I mean, did you make up things in them?
Yeah, well, I've always been, you know, somebody who's kind of mixed my own life and what I hoped would happen with my life, so they ended up being rather fantastical.
Right. I always figured when other girls, you know, young girls were like playing house or playing school, you were playing showbiz.
I was, actually. I used to go down into our basement in Flint, Michigan and like run a business out of there and make up names of companies and stuff.
For like a movie studio?
No, there were more corporations. I got into the movie business a little bit later. But I also performed theatrical productions in the basement.
Which ones?
Well, specifically Hello, Dolly, because I'd gone to see it when I was 8 years old in Detroit when Carol Channing was trying it out. So I memorized the entire score, and I would put the record on, and I'd sing all the parts and drive all my relatives crazy.
It's really funny that you should emulate this kind of, you know, mature...
Yes.
Mature actress.
It was funny, actually. Very strange.
You loved Barbara Streisand, too, right?
Yes, yes. When I was young, I loved Barbara.
And what did she do for you?
I don't know. She had a sense of craziness and freedom, and she was kooky, you know? And it was great to be kooky in the 60s when you were a little kid, you know?
Did you identify with her because of her Jewishness?
Well, that was part of it, you know, certainly. But I think it was more about her, you know, just her sense of style and flair and excitement at life.
So did you always have a sense of what was imaginary and what was real, or did it ever blur in your mind?
No, I don't think it ever blurred. I mean, I just spent a lot of hours fantasizing about what my life was going to be like when I was an adult, and it's quite similar to my fantasies, I must say.
So what were the fantasies?
That I'd be whisked around in limousines and flying all over the world and, you know, meeting great people and being imaginative and doing, hopefully, good work, you know, and performing.
So when did you go to Hollywood?
I actually moved there May 5th, 1974, to be exact, for some reason. It was Cinco de Mayo, so I always remember that day.
So you worked, I think, by day as a manicurist, and at night you tried to do the comedy clubs?
Yes, that's exactly what I was doing.
Were you good at schmoozing when you were manicuring people's nails?
Well, I was certainly good at keeping these women coming back every week and, you know, and feeling comfortable with me. I mean, it's a very intimate thing, doing somebody's nails.
What was the clientele like?
They were mainly women... 35, 40 and upward, you know, upper middle class, you know, housewives from Beverly Hills. Nice people.
So when you started off in the comedy clubs, I mean, you're not a traditional stand-up comic.
No.
So what kind of material did you do?
Well, it was like the infancy of what I do now. I mean, there were like little snippets, little like weird observations and asides and characters interwoven with little a cappella musical moments. And that was just something that was instinctive for me because I was so akin to musical comedy. In a way, it was like kind of a postmodern cabaret, you know, experience that I didn't even know what I was creating when I was doing it, but it was something instinctive.
How did it go over?
Well, you know, not great with like the club owners and the kind of people at large, but then, you know, slowly over the years people started getting into it and my style kind of caught on, but it took a long time.
You had several, like, turning points in your career. One of them was doing King of Comedy.
Right.
Another was doing your one-person show in New York, which was adapted into a film. Was there a point where you realized that to really make it, you had to go through a period of like, doing it your way and not trying to just get cast in other people's movies?
Well, it just seemed after King of Comedy, there weren't a lot of films that captured my interest. I mean, there's just not a lot of roles out there that seem to be right for me. So then I was kind of forced back into focusing on my own work. And since I'm such a determined person and somebody who really has such a strong voice, it just seemed like it was inescapable, really, that this was going to be the way I directed my career.
It's really interesting to me that after having this really quirky career, that you end up on America's most popular sitcom, Roseanne.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't
it? Yeah. How'd you get the part?
Well, I had met Roseanne and Tom at a party in L.A., and we started talking, and I was always a little bit envious of the way she came to town, and I'd been there for a long time, and she just got her own series, and I thought, oh, man, some people are lucky. But then I start talking to her, and we had a lot of similar, you know, points of view on the world. I mean, she's Jewish. She's from Utah. I'm Jewish. I grew up in Arizona, and there was that kind of, you know, detached experience we'd both had, and we really hit it off. I just thought, oh, God, I can't believe how great she is. She's like a really cool person. Then a few weeks later, they called and said, would I like to come on and do this character, you know, play Tom's fiancée, wife, and I said, yeah, I mean, if I'm going to do any show, it would be Roseanne's, you know, I mean, it's the number one show. They tackle touchy subjects, and especially after meeting her, I just thought, this is cool. And then it parlayed into something, you know, longer and more more permanent.
How did the plot twist came about where your character decided to come out?
Well, we were talking about it the end of the first season that I did the show, and I thought it might be funny if Jackie, the sister, and I had an affair because she's always going through a million different men and everything. But I guess they were afraid that it might limit both characters. So they liked the idea, but they decided to bring somebody else in for me, i.e. Morgan Fairchild.
Right. The kind of star you had not yet worked with.
Yeah, really. But, you know, the kind of star I was destined to work with. So that's how that happened. But, you know, I think we're moving on to other things now. Who knows where we're going this season.
So you're still in the series for this
season?
Yeah,
I'm going to do it this season again.
You know, the Arnolds have a really, like, public confessional relationship with their TV viewers. What's it been like for you to watch the impact of that on their viewers and on them? Because you have this really public life, but most of what you do in public is not necessarily you. It's
right.
All these characters who you
yes,
are.
Yes, yes, personas.
So it's personas. So you could be really, really confessional, but it's almost always in persona.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, when I really want to be honest, I try to expose the vulnerability as opposed to, like, really getting into, like, specifics. I don't think it's necessary for me. I think for them, it's just, you know, they're under the microscope anyways, and I think that they just enjoy it, you know? They're just very honest people. They're very comfortable with their relationship and, you know, all their problems that they have individually and together. And I just think that it's something, they like that energy, they like the turmoil, and something that they feel very comfortable with.
Sandra Bernhardt is my guest, and she has a new book called Love, Love, and Love. It's a collection of her short pieces. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Sandra Bernhardt is my guest, actress, performance artist, co-star of Roseanne, and author of the new book Love, Love, and Love. It seems you're getting to live the kind of fabulous life that you've,
Dreamed about
and parodied.
Yes.
So I figure that this is something that you've both died for, but also had some contempt for.
Well, it's a fine line to walk, you know, because there's always part of your humanity you don't want to lose, and it seems that when you get caught up with a certain genre of people, it's threatened. But you know, I've been lucky. I've managed to meet the really wonderful people in unexpected high places.
So what do you like and not like about fame?
Well, I've learned a lot of lessons the past 5 years since I did my show in New York, and I think the most important thing for me at this point is that I don't get caught up in misrepresented situations, things that I don't really believe in, but we're having fun with at the moment, but, you know, they have such consequences that you really have to think twice about presenting them publicly.
Are you alluding to your friendship with Madonna and its public nature on the Letterman show?
Yes. Well, I know it's not so much that, you know, of the content that was exposed, whether true or untrue, but just that it's really not about my work. And I think I reached kind of dangerous proportions of eclipsing my work, and the fact that I'm somebody who gets up every day and writes and you know, prepares material and goes on the road. And I mean, my career is so eclectic and takes up so much of my time that I think it was really taking the focus off what I'm really about, which is my work, and what I love is my work. And the fame and the glamour and the byproducts of my work are things that are not nearly as important to me. And I think it really kind of shook me to my core and brought me back to my basic, you know, kind of desire to be me and my work.
What were the problems you ran into, though, that you're alluding to?
Well, just the kind of prurient interest in things that don't really reflect who I am on a day-to-day basis, you know, sexuality and parties and this kind of, like, you know, slimy, dirty, greasy kind of aspects of being in the public eye, which are to me, just nauseating.
Well, here's something I'm curious about, if you don't mind my asking. I mean, you've been kind of public about the fact that you've had relationships with men and women.
Mm.
A lot of people who are gay or bisexual in Hollywood or any part of the entertainment business are really afraid to come out, especially, I think, in Hollywood, because there's this whole thing that if you're bisexual or if you're gay or lesbian, that no one will be able to relate to you in a heterosexual role again. There's this real fear that a lot of people in Hollywood have about that.
Yeah.
So do you feel that this has affected you in any way, that it's hurt your professional, the offers that you get, or, you know, your credibility or anything?
I think that, you know, besides the sexual aspects of, you know, of my life, I think that just who I am as a performer in terms of the kinds of bold ideas I present, the combination has probably prevented me from getting the roles that Bette Midler covets right now. But those roles don't interest me. I don't want to become somebody that can step into anything, you know? That scares me. I don't want to take away from my uniqueness. I mean, you know, I try to use my role models as people like Patti Smith, you know, people who have the courage to, like, leave completely and just go raise a family and then come back and, you know, you can't take the brilliance away from an artist. You can't take the passion away from an artist. And I think at the end of the day, that's all you really have.
I guess if you don't mind answering this, based on your experience, do you think it is really dangerous for people in Hollywood to come out if they're gay or bisexual?
No, I don't think so. I think if somebody is comfortable with it, I think if they have a certain image, they're going to continue to work. And I think that things have changed quite a bit in the past 2 years. I mean, Lesbian Chic is, you know, apparently very in.
Yes. Well, did you see the Vanity Fair cover with Katie Lang?
Of course.
What did you think of that?
Well, for myself personally, I thought it was kind of trivial and kind of irritating. But I think in the bigger picture, I think it's great for the American public to see something like that in a weird way, because it brought humor to it and accessibility and kind of makes it just, you know, acceptable, you know, easy to the eye, I guess.
You know, I have a friend who wanted to write an article about you and pitched you to one magazine who said that they thought, it was a few years ago, a couple of years ago, that they thought you were maybe too peripheral. And then he was thinking, well, maybe Playboy, but he thought that you might be more interested in actually posing for Playboy than being the subject of an article. And sure enough, right afterwards, there you were posing in Playboy.
That's brilliant.
How did you get to do that?
Well, there's a wonderful woman there named Patty Baudet, who's one of the editors, and I guess she got the brilliant insight, and she called my people, and it just kind of came together. I was working a lot with a photographer named Michelle Comte, and we'd done a series of photos, and it just seemed like a natural evolution in the work we were doing, and everything kind of came together, and I think Playboy was really trying to expand their image and their audience, and with Christy Hefner, who's, like, a very cool woman.
What was in it for you? Why did you want to do it?
Well, it was a combination of things. They offered me a lot of money, and, you know, I always like taking money for things that are easy and I think, you know, interesting and kind of, you know, stimulating, as opposed to, like, doing a bad movie. I'd rather be naked in Playboy than be in, like, you know, Kick Your Hooves Out Part 3, whatever, you know. I mean, it's like, you have to work, like, for 3 months for the same amount of money. It's not fair. No, I don't know. It was... The money was part of it, but it was also something that I thought was a wonderful opportunity for a woman like myself who had posed so many controversial ideas to be in a magazine where people, you know, normally look at women in a very kind of strictly get-off kind of way. And I think that because I got to write the text and I also got to pose in ways that were not just like, I'm the bimbo. You know, I think it was good for everybody. I think it was good for men. I think it was good for their audience, and it was good for me.
You're not self-conscious about your body, are you?
No, I'm not. Not in those situations. I am, when, you know, in my private life.
You are?
Yeah, I'm self-conscious about everything in my private life. I mean, I think one-on-one in relationships is where it all really matters.
Why are you so almost exhibitionistic in public life and self-conscious in private life?
Well, I think it's much easier to expose yourself to big groups of strangers than it is to one person that you have a lot at stake with.
Mm-hmm.
That's why. I guess it's just easier. I don't know. You're not going to see these people, really. I mean, you're not going to really connect with them or have to deal with them on any emotional level. It's just kind of, you're putting out ideas and concepts and then walking away from it.
So when you go shopping for yourself, do you go to all the fabulous places now?
No, I don't. I go exclusively to my friend Isaac Mizrahi, who dresses me.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, first of all, for me, he's the, you know, his clothes are perfect.
Uh-huh.
They're made for my body. And it's so much easier than going shopping, and he really, you know, knows how to put me together. I just can't deal with going shopping anymore, except if I go to The Gap, maybe.
So that must be swell to have somebody who
it is.
Dresses you.
It's really spoiled me. Terribly. But it's a lot of fun.
So that's a dream come true, right?
I mean, yes.
I'm sure you imagined that back when you were in your basement.
Oh, absolutely.
A kid, right?
Absolutely. That was tops on the list. I mean, there are other designers who, you know, I occasionally wear their clothes who are, you know, also very talented. But Isaac is my dear friend, and he's just, you know, I'm his muse, I guess, in a certain way.
Have you met Barbara Streisand?
Yeah, I met her at a party or a screening in Beverly Hills one night, and she was wearing a big hat. And she kind of looked down at me, and the hat kind of fell across her eyes, and she just kind of nodded. And that was it. She wasn't very nice to me.
Really?
I was really devastated. I was, like, crushed. I was like, but Barbara, I love you. You know, I mean, you were my whole life. So that was very painful and disappointing, but I don't hold it against her.
Well, she's changed so much from the time when you wanted to be her back in the 60s.
I think we need to get into a time machine and go back to 1963 to 65 and meet her then. You know, then maybe it would be a little different.
Sandra Bernhardt, her new book is called Love, Love, and Love. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.